press the button. Yeah. So I'm going to review thyroid function test today, and I want to make it as interactive as possible. So any questions, interrupt me anytime. I'll give a few introductory remarks about thyroid hormone physiology, sort of the very basic stuff, and then we'll go into the clinical assessment of patients with suspected thyroid problems. So, key thing you need to remember, and that's whenever you think about thyroid function test, you should remember the feedback cycle between thyroid and pituitary and hypothalamus. The main feedback happens at the pituitary level, and the pituitary senses and maintains thyroid hormone levels very well regulated in normal people by altering the amount of TSH that's produced and secreted and stimulates the thyroid. The thyroid is totally dependent on TSH. In the absence of TSH, the thyroid goes to sleep. So you can never interpret one or the other without really looking at both. So I strongly recommend that you never get just the T4 level or the TSH level. Always get the two together so you can put it to the context of the feedback cycle. And it costs pennies. The primary care doctors say, you know, you just get a TSH and you know everything about thyroid. Number one, you miss certain cases, which we talk about. And number two, they don't hesitate to send a patient for an MRI or for a CAT scan, but a T4 level is too much. All right. Thyroid hormone is one of the most extreme situations in terms of binding and free hormone. Many of the hormones occur both in a bound and free state in the circulation, like, for example, steroids. Cortisol is bound 90% to cortisol binding protein, and many of the proteins are bound to some binding proteins. In the thyroid hormone field, it's particularly extreme. Anybody has an idea what percent of T4 is bound in the circulation? Any other guess, estimates? 90? So the 97? The three binding proteins are thyroxine binding globulin, transthyretin, and albumin. And about 80% is bound to TBG of the one that's bound. Transthyretin is about 10 to 15%, and albumin 5 to 10%. Albumin has a very low affinity, there's lots of it there, has a low affinity, so it binds a relatively small amount. So the amount bound is 99.97%. 0.03% is free. And that's why that's the main difficulty over the years has been to estimate. Because of the free hormone hypothesis, we assume that only the free fraction of the hormone can enter cells and can bind to receptors, and the bound one is just a reservoir. The difficulty in thyroid hormone diagnosis is primarily due to get a correct estimate of the free T4, which is, as I said, 0.03% of the total. It's very easy to measure the total, but to estimate that accurately, that free fraction, is very difficult. And the current assay that's available uses a low affinity antibody to not compete. When you add a tracer to the system, you compete the tracer on the antibody between tracer and free hormone, and to not pull off the hormone for the antibody, to pull off the hormone from the bound fraction, they use a low affinity antibody. And for most circumstances, it gives a relative reasonable good estimate, but it's not a true free T4 measurement. The only way you can accurately by equilibrium dialysis, which is a very cumbersome and expensive way of doing it, and therefore clinically it's not available, really. So free T4 is a hormone, thyroid hormone. If you look at the receptors in target tissues, which practically every cell in the body responds to thyroid hormone, you find exclusively T3 on the receptor. There's no T4. Free T4 is only a pro-hormone. It gets converted by deiodination. There are three enzymes, but important one is a 5' deiodinase that converts T4 to T3 and therefore activates the hormone. T3 is the most active hormone, and free T4 basically is a precursor. There's another enzyme that is 5-deiodinase, which goes in this step, and this is a degradation pathway. So if T4 gets, if you take out an inner iodine from the, you remember the four iodines so two in the outer ring and two in the inner ring. If you take one out of the inner ring, you get a reverse T3, which is a stereoisomer of T3, but it's totally biologically inactive as far as we can tell. So this is a degradation pathway, and this is the activation pathway, and they ultimately end up with, the metabolism ends up with T2 as the further degradation pathway. So the sequential deiodination takes place. And this is of some interest, and I'll come back to that for clinical purposes. Rarely we need it, but I'll mention it. So let's talk about a patient that we want to assess for possibility of hyperthyroidism. Or we can ask hypothyroidism. Let's start out with hypothyroidism, because that's straightforward. Hypothyroidism, what would you expect somebody with hypothyroidism? What test would you want to get? A TSH, certainly, right? And a primary hypothyroidism, because if you don't supply thyroid hormone, the TSH is going to go up, and therefore it's a very sensitive way of looking at primary hypothyroidism. TSH will go up before the thyroid hormone levels fall below the normal range. You have to keep in mind that the normal range applies to a population, but not to an individual. So if you're free T4, let's say the normal range is something like 0.822, if I have a TSH of 0.9 and I go up to 1.6, I may already be slightly hyperthyroid, even though I'm still in the normal range. The TSH will already be completely suppressed, probably. The thyrotroph in the pituitary is extremely sensitive and has a, and the range in a normal person is maybe 20% variation, perhaps, in the free T4 level in a normal person, but it's very tightly regulated. And so primary hypothyroidism, the TSH is elevated. So I told you before, you should always get a TSH under free T4. Now you could say, all right, TSH is always elevated. What do I need a free T4 for? I already know what the diagnosis is. So I wouldn't have made that comment unless there are some exceptions to this rule, right? So what conditions can you think of where the TSH is elevated and you don't have hypothyroidism? Subclinical. All right, but that's still hypothyroidism. Subclinical is... It's unfortunate. This is an unfortunate term. They use this term for describing people that have an elevated TSH and normal thyroid function tests otherwise, normal free T4 and T3. I would say their free T4 and T3 is not really normal. It's just too high for them, and that's why the TSH is suppressed. However, the term subclinical I think the term subclinical should be applied to patients who don't have no clinical symptoms and are on a hypothyroid, right, or subclinical hyperthyroid, vice versa. The fact that it's, but this has come to be stuck in the literature, so that's what we refer to as subclinical hypothyroid. Okay, that's one possibility. But there are other possibilities. TSH elevated and you don't have a VT4. I'm not telling you what it is.
Secondary condition is like hypothyroidism, but you have a problem in the thyroid, but
secondary what?
Hyperthyroid.
Secondary due to what? Okay. In fact, it's a rare condition. I've seen one case of a pituitary tumor that produces TSH. And the patient was hyperthyroid with a slightly elevated TSH.
I had a patient who is hypothyroid with essential hypothyroidism with a TSH which was elevated.
All right, very good. But you wouldn't have missed that patient because the TSH is elevated, so you thought it was primary hypothyroid, but that you mischaracterized the patient just by getting just the TSH. So that's an important teaching point about. So when the TSH is elevated, you can have primary hypothyroidism, or you can actually have a pituitary tumor that produces and that causes hyperthyroidism. So it doesn't tell you really what the story is. That's why you need the 3T4. But there's the other problem that you were alluding to, which is secondary hypothyroidism. If you have a pituitary tumor or some other pathology, hypothalamic pituitary, where you don't have TRH or where you pituitary thyrotrophs are destroyed, you get hypothyroidism, right? You measure the TSH in these patients. What do you expect to see? You expect to see a low TSH. And what we often find is a normal or slightly elevated TSH. Why is that? This is very important. That's why you cannot rely. Just because you have a normal TSH, you cannot say the patient cannot have any thyroid problem. They can have secondary hypothyroidism. It's not that common, so you won't miss that many patients, but you will miss an occasional one. The reason is that the assay used for TSH is immunologically based, and it does not distinguish between normal and biologically inactive TSH. You can have TSH that's not properly glycosylated. Remember that FSH, LH, TSH, HCG, four peptide hormones from pituitary are glycoprotein hormones, right? They have a common alpha subunit and they have a distinct beta subunit, and if it's not properly glycosylated, they will not be biologically active and not bind to the receptor. So if you have something here that destroys thyrotrophs, so you don't make TSH, then you get full thyroid hormones and an increased demand for TSH from the pituitary. If there are any cells left that can make it a little bit, they may make it but not properly process it. So you're making a little bit of TSH, not very much. But the half-life of that TSH is prolonged because it can't bind to the receptor. It doesn't get cleared by receptor-mediated endocytosis. So they have TSH that's measurable and sometimes even elevated slightly. And when you treat them, eventually it will all clear out and they go to essentially zero TSH. And then you get the referrals from the primary care doctor and say, you're giving the patient too much thyroid hormone, the TSH is zero. So this is an important point. Secondary hypothyroidism, undiagnosed, untreated, can have a normal or measured TSH because the antibody does not distinguish between glycosylated and non-glycosylated. Okay? All right. So hypothyroidism is really pretty straightforward. Primary, the most common is always primary, and so we don't need to spend much time. We could talk about intricacies about how to treat these patients and what rate you go up in the thyroid hormone and all this, but today I'm just going to talk about evaluation of thyroid function. So we're going to go to hyperthyroidism, which is more tricky. So you have a patient comes in with new onset atrial fibrillation and you have to rule out hyperthyroidism. So what test do you get? So we always get the same test, right? We get a TSH and we get a free T4. So what do you expect to see? Hyperthyroidism.
Suppressed TSH.
Suppressed TSH. An elevated free T4, right? That would be make the diagnosis of hyperthyroidism. In the simple case, that's fine, and you don't need to any other test to determine the patient has hyperthyroidism. Of course, you should always examine the patient first and see, look for clinical signs. And most patients with hyperthyroidism, even the most mild forms, have some tachycardia or atrial fibrillation. And then you look for pathognomonic signs of Graves' disease, because if you have those, then you can abbreviate your workup. If somebody has typical pathognomonic signs of Graves' disease, then you know it's not some other form of hyperthyroidism, because they may require a different form of treatment. What are the pathognomonic signs of Graves' disease? Exophthalmos, meaning proptosis or orbitopathy, we call it now. Ophthalmopathy or orbitopathy, which is due to a deposition of aminoglycans and in the retroorbital tissue and swelling of the fat and muscles and pushing out of the eye bulb out of the socket. Can be asymmetric, can be symmetric. And it's much more difficult to deal with than the thyroid disease itself. So that's one. What is the other? Very good. If you have a bruise over the thyroid, and that's why whenever you feel for a thyroid, you feel somebody's hyperthyroid, you examine thyroid not by palpation only. Excuse me. But you want to listen to it. Because if you have a clear-cut bruise over the thyroid, which is a high-pitched sound, gushing sound, have a patient take a few breaths in and out and then hold their breath and you listen, and if you hear this gushing sound, which is not just transmitted heart sounds, then you can be sure the patient has Graves' disease. No other condition will ever do this. Because in Graves' disease, because it's autoimmune thyroid disease where you have antibodies that stimulate all the follicles of the thyroid, you have sometimes such increased blood flow in the thyroid that you get this bruise. Now, not having the bruise doesn't rule out Graves' disease by any means. You don't have to have any pathognomonic signs and still have Graves' disease. But if you do have them, that's why you look for them. It can be very useful. So thyroid bruise is the second pathognomonic sign. You have to be sure to distinguish it between a carotid bruise, of course. And then what's the third sign? Yes, pre-tibial mixed edema. For some reason, a few percent of patients with Graves' disease get dermopathy, and the most characteristic sign is pre-tibial raised lesions in the pre-tibial area that look like mixed edema, is non-pitting, and when you biopsy it also looks histologically like mixed edema, but why it occurs there we have no idea. So if you have any of those signs, then you know you have Graves' disease. Otherwise, you have to go by biochemistry only. So, what about if you have a normal free T4 with a suppressed TSH? What do you do then? Do you get any other test, or what do you do? Yes, you get a T3, and only then you You don't need a T3 otherwise. If the free T4 is elevated, you know you have hyperthyroid. But if the free T4 is not elevated, you may have what's called T3 toxicosis. T3 toxicosis is where the T3 is elevated and the free T4 is not, in the context of hyperthyroidism. And that is sometimes seen, not so rare. The thyroid gets stimulated by TSH and becomes more efficient. So the T3 that's circulating is not only derived, like in most normal people, 80% of the circulating T3 is derived by peripheral conversion of T4 secreted by the thyroid. In the thyroid that's stimulated, it becomes more efficient and sometimes secretes preferentially so much T3 that the free T4 is not, doesn't have to be elevated, and you still have hyperthyroidism. T3 toxicosis can be seen in any form of hyperthyroidism. What about if both of them are normal? Both of them are normal, and the TSH is suppressed. There are several conditions that can cause this constellation. Number one is what we call subclinical hyperthyroidism, that you already brought up with hypothyroidism, in this case subclinical hyperthyroidism, because the thyroid trough is so sensitive to fluctuation in thyroid hormone. First thing that happens, the TSH goes down before the thyroid hormone levels really rise above the normal range. So that's subclinical hyperthyroidism, which is a topic by itself, and because of the drug companies want to put everybody on thyroid hormone, they've tried to lower the threshold more and more that everybody gets put on thyroid hormone, which is nonsense, of course. We use a certain threshold. If the TSH is below a certain level, then we consider treatment, but otherwise we don't. I won't go into subclinical hyperthyroidism any further. What other condition can give you this?
Hypoproteinemia.
Huh?
Hypoproteinemia.
If you have hypoproteinemia, that could affect your total T4 because maybe the thyroid binding proteins are also low. So in sick people, for example, you can get low thyroid hormone levels, but it doesn't affect the TSH. Hypoproteinemia would not affect the TSH. In pregnancy, you have increased TBG and you have increased total thyroid hormone, but the free T4 is normal, and the TSH is completely normal. Except, since you brought up pregnancy, let me just show you. The first trimester, what happens is that the TSH does go down a little bit and then it comes back up. Why is that? Right. Because HCG peaks at the end of the first trimester and then goes down. And HCG is slightly related to TSH. And at very high levels, HCG can cross-react at the receptor and bind to the TSH receptor and stimulate the thyroid. That's why we get a slight fall of TSH in early pregnancy. And if you have somebody with choriocarcinoma, they can be frankly hyperthyroid because they have sky-high levels of HCG. What's the most common cause of a suppressed TSH in non-thyroidal patients? Right. The sick euthyroid. They call it a syndrome, but it's really not a syndrome because, I mean, they're sick people and they have abnormal thyroid function tests. And they're abnormal because we don't know how to properly assess their thyroid function test during sickness. That's more like it. But anyway, the constellation of thyroid hormone levels in sick people is referred to as a sick euthyroid syndrome, defined as people that get sick and their thyroid function get abnormal, and on recovery they're completely normalized without any intervention towards the thyroid. And in one study, for example, they took all comers into a community hospital and measured TSH at admission and 1 month after discharge. And 20% had an abnormal TSH on admission with normal TSH after discharge. 20%. Very, very common. What was the TSH in most of these people? Low. So, sick euthyroid has three features. One is low TSH. It's usually not as low as in true hyperthyroidism. To true hyperthyroidism, it's below 0.01, and usually these patients are not that suppressed. Why is it? Why is the TSH suppressed in sick people? It's not completely clear, but one major thought is that, or evidence supports this, that there are cytokines and steroids in stressed patients that impair the ability of TRH to stimulate the thyrotroph. So you have a fall in TSH because the responsiveness to TRH is inhibited by cytokines and steroids. So it's very common to find in sick people a suppressed TSH. What is the second feature? In fact, that was the feature that was first discovered, because when they started, when they developed immunoassay for T3, when they learned how to measure T3, they found that there are a lot of people that have low T3s, and they're perfectly fine. They don't have anything wrong with their thyroid. It used to be called first the low T3 syndrome. Now, why is the T3 low? The T3 is low because this enzyme, the type 2 deiodinase, or 5' deiodinase, which sits in the liver and in the kidney primarily and is responsible for conversion of T4 to T3, is very nutritionally sensitive. And so with starvation, with sickness of many kinds, you get inhibition of this enzyme and therefore decreased conversion of T4 to T3. And that's why the T3 falls. If you put yourself on, if you don't eat for 24 hours, your T3 plummets. Or if you switch to an isocaloric diet without carbohydrates, if you're capable of doing that, your T3 plummets. It's a carbohydrate-induced enzyme. If you take away the carbs, the T3 goes down. So that's the reason why the T3 is low in many sick people. And then the third thing that you find in sick euthyroid is that they also have a low T4. And primarily the total T4 is low, but in that circumstance, which is basically due to, and those are the very sick, the sickest people. If you go into the ICU with people with sepsis, with malignancies, or end-stage cardiac disease, they all have low free T4. But if you measure their free T4, many of them will have a low free T4 because this assay does not work properly in that circumstance. The one that we have available. And in fact, it's like the worst prognosis. The worst people are going to die who have the lowest T4. We don't use it, of course, because we're not going to withhold treatment for somebody because of poor prognosis. But just to point out, so this is due to a fall in these binding proteins because they're made by the liver. If you get sick, you know, you shut off protein synthesis, essentially, and the binding proteins go down, and therefore the total T4 goes down to very low levels. If you accurately measure the free T4, which has been done in a number of studies, it's normal or even slightly elevated, so they don't really have hypothyroidism. And intervention trials to try to give sick people thyroid hormone have been abandoned because they have caused more harm than benefit. So, but you should be aware of this, because if you have a very sick person in the hospital, don't measure their thyroid hormone levels. You're just going to get confused, unless you really strongly suspect they have a thyroid problem. And then there's one trick that you can use, but we rarely do it, which is to measure reverse T3. That's why I drew this thing up here. Reverse T3 gets generated from free T4. Only the free fraction is susceptible to metabolism. So normally, reverse T3 reflects how much free T4 there is. And in hypothyroidism, reverse T3 will go down, and hyperthyroidism will go up, because there's more substrate there. But in sick euthyroid, the free T4 is not altered, but its metabolism to T3 is impaired. So there's actually increased, you can actually get a buildup of reverse T3, and this doesn't get metabolized because it's the same enzyme that converts reverse T3 to T2. It's the same enzyme that generates T3 from T4. So therefore, in people that have sick euthyroid, everything is low, and you measure their reverse T3 and it's normal or elevated. And that tells you their free T4 is perfectly fine. They don't have hypothyroidism. Can be useful. It's an assay they have to specifically set up because they don't have enough demand for it, and we don't need it most of the time. So we don't usually send for this test, but it's just interesting to understand a little bit the physiology here. Okay, come back to hypothyroidism. What are the conditions that can give you, beware of asking what low TSH in the context of normal free T4, T3. Alright, so it's subclinical hyperthyroidism and it's sick euthyroid. Those are the two main ones. Now, if you don't draw these numbers and you only get the TSH, you can be fooled in other ways. The low TSH can be due to secondary hypothyroidism or can be due to any of these conditions. But clearly, you can see that it's not sufficient to just get the TSH to assess thyroid function test. Then, there is one more condition that we need to talk about, which is the TSH is normal. I already said, if your TSH is normal, you don't rule out hypothyroidism, because secondary hypothyroidism, TSH, can be normal. But what about hyperthyroidism? Can you have hyperthyroidism with a normal TSH? In thyroiditis, you have an inflammatory process in the thyroid that gets passive leakage of thyroid hormone, shuts off TSH. No, thyroiditis is nothing. Normal TSH. And then you measure your T4, it's elevated. You measure the T3, it's also elevated. There are two conditions that can cause this. One, the one that we already mentioned, the rare pituitary tumor, produces TSH and causes hypothyroidism that way. So it has resulted in elevation of thyroid hormone, but it's not shut off, TSH. That's one thing that's so rare that you'll never see it. The other condition is thyroid hormone resistance. If you have a mutation in the thyroid hormone receptor, that is inactivated mutation, you need more TSH to overcome that. To get enough thyroid hormone function. If it's both alleles are affected, you can't even survive. You'll never see a patient like this because they don't survive. But if you have one allele affected, you can get, because TSH receptor binds, a thyroid hormone receptor binds as a dimer to DNA response elements. And if one of the partners is defective, then the dimer is also not effectively transducing the signal. And therefore, you have essentially a dominant negative effect of a monoallelic problem. And these patients have So therefore you need more thyroid hormone to overcome this block. And therefore you have elevated thyroid hormone levels and until the TSH is normalized. Alright? The thyroid, the pituitary also has a defect, and therefore you need more thyroid hormone to normalize TSH. So that's thyroid hormone resistance. It's also rare, probably won't see it, but just to stress the fact that TSH by itself should never be measured. Always see it in the context with the thyroid hormone levels. Yeah?
So if you have a diagnosis and you want to do a follow-up, do you need to measure every time?
Oh, that's a good point. That's a good point. That I grant you that. If you have established that somebody has primary hypothyroidism and you treat them with thyroid hormone, then you can use the TSH alone as your guide to for your therapy. Except the TSH is much more volatile than VT4. Thyroid hormone has a half-life of a week. So if somebody doesn't take their medication for a few days, sometimes the TSH goes up. And you think, you know, you need to adjust the medication. But if their free T4 is really low, then you know that they are not taking their medication or they are not getting enough. So I've seen some patients that come in with TSH of 100 and they just skip one or two days their medication for some reason. They have very extremely sensitive setback. So that it's always better to get the free T4 along with it, because it tells you when the TSH is low, it tells you the patient is really not taking it for quite some time or not getting enough. But if the free T4 is really low, then you know you need to adjust the medication. If the free T4 is a bit normal, the TSH is a little bit high, then you can say, well, maybe skip one or two days. So in general, you could say the TSH, your aim would be to normalize the TSH, because the free T4 has a relatively wide range and you don't know what the normal value for that patient is. Therefore, we use the TSH to get it into the mid-normal range of the patient. TSH. And they have narrowed the ranges. They're trying to convince people to give thyroid hormone to everybody who has a TSH greater than 4, which is ridiculous. There's signs, there are studies. Nobody has ever shown any adverse effect that you can measure in a patient who has a TSH less than 10. Any hypothyroid equivalent adverse effects on atherosclerosis, whatever. So most endocrinologists agree that in subclinical hypothyroid we don't treat it unless the TSH is above 10. Anyhow, so now we made the diagnosis of hypothyroidism, and then the question is, what do you do next? Is that all you need, or do you need to determine what kind of hypothyroidism you have? Does it make a difference? Do you treat people different with different diseases of the thyroid? If everybody gets antithyroid medication, well, might as well just stop there and give them antithyroid medication. Who doesn't get antithyroid medication with hypothyroidism? Or radioactive iodine, for that matter. Which one? Right. Because if you have an inflammation in the thyroid that passively leaks out thyroid hormone, blocking thyroid hormone synthesis is not going to have any benefit on the patient. It's potentially harmful, because these medications have rare but sometimes very serious side effects, such as agranulocytosis, right? So you don't want to subject somebody to a medication that's potentially life-threatening, actually, if they don't need it. So therefore, yes, we do want to do an additional test to determine what kind of hypothyroidism the patient has. What test do we do? One additional test. What's that?
Radioiodine uptake.
Okay, great. That's exactly the test that I would like to see. How would that help you?
So if it is thyroiditis, the uptake will be decreased. And if it is Graves, it should, or any cause where you're increasing the synthesis, even multinodular or toxic nodule, it should be increased.
Exactly. So The thyroid, if it's overproducing thyroid hormone, you will have an increased uptake in most cases because it's an iodine-rich molecule, and therefore you need more iodine to make more thyroid hormone. The thyroid has a trapping mechanism, a sodium iodide symporter. It takes up iodide and gets converted, gets peroxidase, makes iodine radicals and gets incorporated into the thyroglobulin molecule. You have the synthesis. But this is highly dependent on iodide. So, therefore, in most cases of hyperthyroidism, you have increased reductive iron uptake. But then there are cases where you have a decreased uptake, and subacute thyroiditis is the most notorious one of this group. And so it's kind of interesting. It was first detected like this, so the people discovered the first description by Descartes was a very characteristic syndrome of young women with very tender thyroid, barely lets you touch them, and they have some constitutional symptoms. They basically had typically a viral syndrome a week to 10 days before. They still have an increased set rate. They don't feel well, and they may have so much pain in their neck that they can hardly eat because any movement in their jaw will hurt their neck. And that's the classical subacute thyroiditis. And I've seen a few cases. It's not very common, but we see some cases. But it's just the tip of the iceberg. Subsequently, in more recent years, it was found that there are many cases of silent thyroiditis, where you don't have any pain. Probably depends on the rate of stretching the capsule. You know, the capsule is what's innervated. And if you slowly stretch a capsule, like in the heart, if you slowly extend the heart to have a huge pericardial effusion in mixed edema, you usually don't have much of a compromise because the capsule can stretch. But if you acutely tamponade the heart, you know, you die. And in this case, the pain is dependent probably on the rate of stretching of the capsule. So if it's more acute, then it hurts a lot. And if it's more gradual, it hurts less or not at all. So if you do a biopsy on the thyroid, we don't need it, but if you were to do a biopsy, you find giant cells in the classical Descartes thyroiditis. And the silent ones, most commonly, is a variation of autoimmune thyroid disease. Autoimmune thyroid disease can have many different ways of presenting. Okay, so subacute thyroiditis is all lumped together, this form. And what's interesting about also, people thought, okay, the thyroid is damaged, so it can't take up iodine. That's why the uptake is low. You think that's the reason? Right, because if you give these people an injection of TSH, the uptake is perfectly fine. The thyroid follicle is not damaged to the point that it can't take up the iodine. It's just that its thyroid hormone is leaking out because the integrity of the follicles is disrupted. Yes, perfect. That's very good. Okay, so that's subacute thyroiditis. Now, what are the most common of hyperthyroidism? Of course, Graves' disease is the most common form. Probably 75% to 80% of patients with hyperthyroidism have Graves' disease. Then you have, what are other forms of hyperthyroidism do you have?
The toxic nodular.
Okay, you have toxic multinodular goiter, and then you also have toxic adenoma. It's interesting, we now know that the reason why patients with nodular goiters can get hyperthyroidism, typically multinodular goiters start out non-toxic and then eventually develop autonomy. In other words, production of thyroid hormone independent of TSH. And in the case of the toxic adenoma, it's been shown now, some time ago already, that you have mutation in a single, somatic mutation in a single cell. In what gene? Anybody knows? And the gene encoding the TSH receptor. It makes the TSH receptor constitutively active. It doesn't require the ligand. You have the receptors there that are constitutively active, and therefore TSH is both stimulates production of thyroid hormone and growth. So this single cell that has acquired this somatic mutation will now grow up as a clonal tumor. When it reaches a size large enough, it'll produce hyperthyroidism. What do you see on a scan in a patient like this when you do a thyroid scan? You talked about... You basically see a hot nodule. A hot nodule, by definition, means that there's only uptake in that nodule. The rest of the thyroid is suppressed. Because this nodule produces thyroid hormone independent of TSH, and the rest is dependent on TSH. If TSH is suppressed, the rest is suppressed. So therefore you have a hot nodule. In a toxic multinodular goiter, you may have several foci of uptake, more scattered. But this is what a toxic adenoma is like. Now, with a suppressed radioiodine uptake, are there any other conditions other than subacute thyroiditis that can give you hyperthyroidism with a suppressed uptake?
Exogenous.
All right, very good. So if you take either T4 or T3, too much of it, more than your body normally needs, then you get hyperthyroidism, and you shut off the TSH, and the thyroid doesn't take up any iodine. So that's another condition. What else? Okay, great. Struma ovaria is a teratoma of the ovary with some differentiated thyroid tissue, and sometimes gives rise to hyperthyroidism. And an astute nuclear medicine technician should, in a young woman, or in a woman, should measure the neck. If he doesn't find any uptake there, should go to the pelvis and see if it's there, because you would have the uptake. There's uptake, but it's in the wrong place. Struma ovaria. I've seen one case. Happens. Rare. What else? Any other thoughts? Okay, so yeah, you could have hyperthyroidism from a thyroid just a little bit, but it would still be in the neck, would be very close. It's just have you seen any case? Is there any case in the world literature reported? Why? Because, see, ectopic hormone production, if you have a peptide hormone, you just need to transcribe one gene abnormally and you get the transcript from a hormone, and then you make a peptide hormone, ACTH, or whatever, ADH, etc. But thyroid hormone has this very intricate and difficult biogenesis, biosynthesis. You need to have all this in place in order to get thyroid hormone. So no cancer will ever differentiate to that degree to give you, unless it's a teratoma with thyroid tissue in it, will give you ectopic thyroid hormone. So you never see ectopic steroid hormone production for that reason, because cortisol, to make it, you need the sequential transformation of cortisol, right? Of cholesterol. Sequential transformation to get finally to in a coordinated way. So there's no tumor that has, unless it's derived, there's no ectopic tumor.
Unless it's choriocarcinoma
produces HCG, which is a normal product of it, so it's not really ectopic, but it causes hyperthyroidism. But it falls on this side, molar hyperthyroidism. Because you increase thyroid hormone production, you don't have suppressed you do not have passive leakage of the thyroid. You have stimulation by something other than immunoglobulin. You have stimulation by HCG. Huh? So there's one other thing. We take excessive iodine. You can get hypothyroidism. It's called iodine-induced hypothyroidism. And when you do an uptake, it may be very low because, why? Because you increase the pool size. The way radioactive iodine uptake is measured is you give a trace dose one day, and the next day the patient comes back and you check how much of that trace dose ends up in the thyroid. That's why you get a percent uptake. And but this doesn't really tell you how much iodine is going in, it just tells you how much radioactive iodine goes in. So if the pool size is huge, if you have a lot of cold iodine there, you may actually have an increased uptake, and yet the tracer is so diluted out that very little of the tracer goes into the thyroid, and therefore the radioactive iodine uptake can be suppressed. Iodine-induced thyrotoxicosis is primarily seen in people with multinodular goitres. If you give them lots of iodine, some of them become hypothyroid. First description by the guy named Basedo, and that's why it's still referred to as Jod Basedo. Jod is the German name for iodine. Basedo is an Austrian investigator who was lived at the same time as Graves and described Graves' disease more or less at the same time. And in the German literature, they refer it as Basedow's disease. When I went to medical school in Berlin, that's what we called it. So, but I think there's general agreement that the Graves is the first one who really put the syndrome together. Anyway, so then there's drug-induced hypothyroidism. What drugs can cause hypothyroidism? Hyperthyroidism. Drug-induced hypothyroidism, which is the most notorious drug doing this. Yes. Amiodarone. There are several mechanisms by which amiodarone can cause it, so we call it type 1 and type 2. Hypothyroidism with amiodarone. One is iodine-induced hypothyroidism because amiodarone is a very iodine-rich molecule. A lot of that iodine dissociates, and therefore, in people with pre-existing goiter, you can get iodine-induced hypothyroidism. That's type 1. And type 2 is it's a subacute thyroiditis-like picture, because there's some kind of chemical thyroiditis in some patients where they have inflammatory response in the thyroid, passive leakage of thyroid hormone, like subacute thyroiditis. And some, in many patients you have the combination of the two. It's very, very common. And anybody who's on amiodarone should have their thyroid function test, because it can cause hypothyroidism. It can even cause hypothyroidism. There's also iodine-induced hypothyroidism, such as lithium-induced hypothyroidism. And those are patients that have autoimmune thyroid disease, such as Hashimoto's, chronic lymphocytic thyroiditis. And when you expose them to iodine, they cannot escape the normal block that happens. There is an autoregulation in the thyroid. If you give to a normal person a large amount of iodine, the thyroid protects itself by blocking uptake and synthesis, shutting off. And then, if you're normal, after a given period of time, the thyroid will resume normal rate of synthesis and secretion of thyroid hormone, despite continued exposure to iodine. And that's called the escape from the Wolff-Chaikoff effect. Wolff-Chaikoff describes this phenomenon. And if you have a sick thyroid that hasn't given rise to hypothyroidism by itself, if you expose it to a challenge like this, either lithium or iodine, you can unmask this latent problem and make the patient, frankly, hypothyroid. You also get a goiter with iodine in those patients. So that's what we call the escape from the Wolff-Chaikoff effect through iodine. So those are the main conditions. Yes. One other thing that we see quite a bit of nowadays is interferon-induced thyroid dysfunction. Interferon doesn't have a direct effect on the thyroid, but it alters immune function, and therefore you can get emergence of autoimmune thyroid disease, both hypothyroidism and hyperthyroidism. People get treated for Hep C or for Hep B. So those are the things you need to. Now, what is postpartum thyroiditis? Anybody heard that term, postpartum thyroiditis? Yes. If you get hyperthyroidism within 6 months after giving birth, a woman gets hyperthyroidism or hypothyroidism, it's often called postpartum thyroiditis. And this is due to the fact that during pregnancy you have an immune suppression and thyroid disease sort of cools off. And as the placenta is released and the baby is gone, the immune system gets reactivated. And then, just like with interferon in this case, the recovery of the suppressed immune system, which was suppressed to prevent rejection of the baby, is now bringing out the autoimmune thyroid disease. Sometimes activation of Graves' disease or thyroiditis. It's transient. Some women get it after every pregnancy. That's interesting. All right, so I think I covered most of hypothyroidism. And are there any questions? Okay, I just saw a patient the other day. Was referred because of normal TSH, and I didn't know what to make of it, so they sent me the patient. 3D4 is 1.3, T3 is 100. Mid-normal range both, and TSH, 0. Patient has absolutely nothing. No tachycardia, palpitation, heat intolerance, nothing. Perfectly fine. No weight loss, no bowel changes, nothing. So what's this patient have? So you could say, maybe she has, by definition, one definition, subclinical hypothyroidism. But there's one other condition that can cause this, and that is if you have anti-idiopathic antibodies against mouse immunoglobulins. The assays all done with murine antibodies, monoclonal antibodies. If your system has an antibody against mouse monoclonal antibodies, mouse antibodies, anti-idiotypic antibodies, you can interfere with the assay, clear the zero TSH, and the patient's perfectly normal, nothing. So what you do is you measure it by another assay, by old-fashioned radioimmunoassay where they used bovine or rabbit antibody, and it's perfectly normal. That's the way you prove that you have an artifactual lowering of TSH. So not every suppressed TSH is due to hypothyroidism or thyroid problem. Okay. Any questions? Yeah.
Can you slow down, prevent the progression of the orbitopathy in Graves by giving early treatment, or is there any way, or is going to progress?
There are some. The bottom line is that the orbitopathy takes an independent course. Some people gets worse with time, some people gets better, and not necessarily related to the state of the thyroid condition. So I've seen some people that the thyroid floored and they have very little, you treat them, and all of a sudden the eyes flare up, some people believe that radioactive iodine treatment actually makes them worse, because perhaps you're releasing some antigens that now stimulate the system. We don't really understand what the exact mechanism is. It's an autoimmune mechanism, but we don't fully understand it. And so various things have been done, and steroids will work to some degree, but you're trading in the side effects of steroids. Most patients end up ultimately with the most severe cases of orbitopathy with some kind of orbital decompression surgery. Just saw the patient the other day who had three or four surgeries. She has a pretty good effect on her cosmetic effect. She doesn't have overt profoundness anymore, but she still has double vision when she looks sideways because the coordination of the muscles is not. So it's a very nasty thing to be. Unfortunately, we see relatively little of it. But people with aggressive eye disease is very, very difficult to deal with. We don't have. There's some monoclonal antibodies that they're experimenting with right now that affect the immune system, but the results so far are not very encouraging. Any other questions? Okay, and the class is dismissed. Thank you.
Thank you.